Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If oil at $107 a barrel doesn't slow the economy down, what might? The economic prospects of $4 or maybe $5 a gallon gas. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday today, the 7th of March. Good, as always, to have you with us. Oil prices bumped right up against $107 a barrel today in New York. Missed it by that much, just a nickel, $106.95 at the close. Rising crude, as you know, has put a bit of a damper on stock prices, but so far there hasn't been much noticeable effect out in the real economy, the one where consumers live. We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth what it might take for that to change.
It may not be oil prices we should worry about, but gas prices. Jeffrey Cleveland is chief economist at Payden & Riegel, which is a money management firm.
My main concern is the impact on the consumer, not so much on the inflation side, but on the consumer spending side.
He says spending by regular people is the key to the recovery. He thinks we might stop spending if oil were to get up into the $150 a barrel range. He says the effects would be broad.
A pullback in auto sales, and that could feed through into U.S. economic growth. A pullback in miles driven, you could see that impact.
Basically, high gas prices force Americans to spend differently. Ken Goldstein is at the Conference Board, which is a nonprofit business research organization. He thinks the economy would notice oil at $120 a barrel.
That's when it would begin to really start to impact our lives, in the sense of the money going into the gas tank. If it costs $50 or $75 to fill up that gas tank, that's money that's not available to fill up the grocery cart.
It'll take much longer for high oil prices to show up in other parts of the economy. Goldstein says we can also feel a little reassured, because if natural gas and coal prices were higher, then we'd really be in trouble. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
We'll take a turn now from oil prices that are rising to Wall Street stars who are falling. This week, hedge fund manager Raj Rajaratnam is set to stand trial for what federal prosecutors are calling the biggest insider trading investigation ever. And prosecutors are off to a good start. 19 people have already pleaded guilty in the case. But Rajaratnam is the star defendant, and his trial puts hedge fund managers back in the unwanted spotlight. Are they trading geniuses, as they would have you believe? Or do they just use their connections to score information to goose their returns? Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
Think of Raj Rajaratnam as the Mark McGuire of Wall Street. In the same way that McGuire kicked off the doping scandal that swept through baseball, Rajaratnam's trial shows that the government is cracking down on insider trading among hedge funds. Chris Whalen, the founder of Institutional Risk Analytics, says investors pay dearly to keep their money with hedge fund managers, so they expect magic and sparkle dust.
There are a lot of funds out there who try and increase their odds of success by cheating, and they're under enormous pressure to do so.
Rajaratnam forged tight ties with the tech industry as an investor. Now the government accuses him of using those connections to make $45 million in illegal profits between 2003 and 2009. Eric Breslin, a partner with law firm Duane Morris, says tight industry ties can often present a problem for hedge funds because they're less regulated.
What is the line between really good and foresighted analysis and trading on inside information? The line can be very, very narrow. You can have 1 2-minute telephone call and make yourself a tremendous amount of money. Hard to pass up.
Rajaratnam beat the market almost every year since 1992. Returns like that, says Chris Whalen, are too good to be honest.
An honest manager is going to be as wrong as many times as they're right.
At the heart of the government's case are hundreds of wiretaps. That's a technique usually used in mob cases. So perhaps the government sees Rajaratnam less as Mark McGuire and more as John Gotti. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Jury selection for the Rajaratnam case begins tomorrow. We got a hold of the juror questionnaire, which includes, as it happens, this question. How honest do you think Wall Street executives are? You can share your answer on our website, marketplace.org. Be honest now. There's some movement in the scandal over botched foreclosure paperwork, the robo-signing revelations of last fall from big banks like Bank of America and Wells Fargo. Attorneys general from all 50 states and federal officials are in talks with the biggest mortgage lenders. Regulators want to establish a code of conduct for mortgage lenders to ideally reduce the number of foreclosures. The enforcer would be a new cop on the beat, as our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
As the state attorneys general met to discuss the foreclosure crisis, advocates for holding banks more accountable chanted outside. The protesters want state and federal bank regulators to force mortgage lenders to reduce principal and lower interest rates for homeowners who owe more than their house is worth. As part of their proposed agreement, the state AGs would require lenders to submit their loan modification formulas to a review by the newly created Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The CFPB would review those formulas from a consumer perspective. Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research says it's the only regulator with any credibility.
These abuses took place when you had the other regulatory agencies basically ignoring them. So this is a bureau that I think people have some confidence in, so it certainly would be the right one to turn to.
But that bureau is still being put together, says Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics.
The CFPB lacks clear enforcement authority, first and foremost, because it doesn't have a confirmed director with express authority under law. So if the CFPB now seeks to exert its authority, that would at least be questioned.
Under the state AG's proposal, bank lenders would have to give each borrower a single case manager to help guide them through foreclosure, and the banks would have to suspend the foreclosure process while documents are under review. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Wall Street gave back a little bit today. Not so bad, all things considered. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you follow luxury retail, if only to daydream occasionally, you're probably familiar with the French conglomerate LVMH and some of its brands, Louis Vuitton, Christian Dior, Hennessy Cognac, to name just a couple. Now it seems its glittering empire is going to extend even farther. LVMH is buying the Italian jewelry giant Bulgari, perhaps setting in motion a luxury land grab as high-end spenders try to make the Great Recession just a memory. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
The luxury retail market is a rarefied universe, and in it, LVMH is like the sun, with most of the luxury industry revolving around it and its colorful founder, billionaire Bernard Arnault.
Their insatiable appetite to control everything, you know, from Tag Heuer to Sephora to Thomas Pink.
That's Faith Hope Consolo with Prudential Douglas Elliman's Retail Group rattling off some of LVMH's 60-some luxury brands. Consolo says the company's so successful because it carefully manages each of them, from fashion houses like Dior to Marc Jacobs to wines like Chateau Dixième to Cheval Blanc. Consolo says you won't find this stuff in a sorry heap on the discount table.
They never go on sale. That's something where they've set the bar much higher than any of the other brands, and that they seem to be able to keep nurturing the customer.
With all its reach, though, watches and jewelry make up only 5% of LVMH's business, far less than its competitors like Richemont. Morningstar analyst Paul Swinan says that's why the Bulgari acquisition makes sense.
Watches and jewelry are most of Bulgari's business. So in one fell swoop, they're more than doubling the size of their watches and jewelry business.
That'll help LVMH better compete as emerging markets boost sales of luxury goods to $1 trillion in just over a decade. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Tomorrow is International Women's Day. Rallies and speeches are planned all over the world, including Cairo, Egypt, in what's being called the Million Woman March. The protests in the Middle East the past month or so haven't explicitly been about women's rights, more about democratic rights for everybody and an end to corrupt regimes. But women have been right at the front of the demonstration in a lot of those countries. And in Egypt, where there is a long tradition of Arab feminism, they are determined not to be sidelined. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports now from Cairo.
A recent mass rally to celebrate Egypt's revolution might have been called the Million Man March, but just as many women were there, in everything from jeans and a t-shirt to niqab, full veil and gown. Yasmina Fifi and Noha Barania are in their early 30s. They teach at a Montessori school. The revolution got them fired up to work after hours as well.
As a group of friends, we're going down to one of our friends' streets to clean it.
Are you at all concerned as women and as workers that if things get more conservative in this country, someone will say that you maybe shouldn't take a job over a man?
We need a lot of standing up for our rights. Tahrir Square is always there. Okay, we'll be here again.
And there is progress to defend. In recent decades, Egyptian women have come to outnumber men at university. But women graduates earn less. Only a small fraction make it into management. And fewer women find work. Men get first shot at jobs in an informal pecking order that favors males supporting their wives and children.
It is very important to liberate women.
That's Dr. Nawal al-Sadawi, author, activist, and the 80-year-old mother of modern Egyptian feminism. Al-Sadawi says under current law, reinforced by patriarchal traditions in Arab culture and Islam, women are far from equal. In many poor families, girls are taken out of school. Nearly half grow up illiterate. Under Islamic law, it's harder for women to divorce, and they're often left destitute.
So now we are asking to omit Article 2 of the Constitution, which says that Islam is the religion of Egypt, of the country. There must be separation of religion and state from all domains of life.
I think this is potentially a battleground as women seek to claim their part of this revolution and to prevent any backsliding.
Eric Goldstein of Human Rights Watch says the most likely source of backsliding is the Muslim Brotherhood. Their headquarters is in a rundown office building. We get on the elevator, and a recorded voice chants a prayer for safe arrival at our floor.
My name is Isamil Aryan. I am a member of the Guidance Bureau of Muslim Brotherhood.
I quote another senior Brotherhood official who said a woman couldn't serve as prime minister, and Islamists who've said women can't be judges. El Aryan, a 56-year-old physician, says this is not the view of the new generation of Brotherhood leaders.
Women can be the prime minister of Egypt. Women are equal to men in Islamic reference.
El Aryan insists the Brotherhood has no concern about women's increasing economic power, even if they supervise men or take scarce jobs.
Prophet Muhammad, before prophecy, was a worker to Khadija, his wife, and she's the owner.
In Egypt's traditional society, though, the reality is considerably less rosy. Zainab Khalifa's in her 50s. Divorced, she employs four workmen in her artisanal jewelry shop. She's had to earn their respect.
You have to prove yourself as a businesswoman, and this is a serious job. This is not something like a hobby.
And what about the Brotherhood gaining influence?
She said, I don't think they would stop her doing anything, but she doesn't like the idea of the Muslim Brotherhood governing.
Right now, though, she's more worried about the economy. Without more sales, it'll be hard to pay the jewelry makers whose families depend on her. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I found myself wanting to imagine it, this idea of these rubber duckies, as the news stories usually said, going adrift.
How a quest to find bath toys in the ocean wound up as a lesson in global economics. But first, yeah, what the heck? Let's do the numbers. Stocks haven't fallen as much as the price of oil has risen, but they sank again today. The Dow Industrials gave back 79 points, 2/3 of 1%, closed at 12,090, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ shed 39 points, about 1.4%. 2745 at the bell. The S&P 500 lost 11 points, 0.8%, ended things at 1310. Oil wasn't the only damper. You know, tech stocks headed south after Wells Fargo downgraded the semiconductor industry, the whole industry. Intel surrendered 1.6%. Shares of smaller rival Advanced Micro Devices drained more than 4% today. But an acquisition spurred big gains by two computer hard drive makers. Western Digital served 15.5% after agreeing to buy Hitachi's hard drive unit for $4.3 billion. Financial stocks all declined. Goldman Sachs led the way down with a 1.1% drop. Goldman's CEO, Lloyd Blankfein, may have to testify in that insider trading trial we told you about earlier. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.51%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up tomorrow. In Washington, the League of American Bicyclists begins its 2011 National Bike Summit. U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood is scheduled to speak. Events around the world mark the 100th anniversary of International Women's Day. And other celebrations include Fat Tuesday, Shrove Tuesday, or Pancake Tuesday, the day to live it up before the beginning of Lent. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. As I mentioned earlier, crude brushed up against $107 a barrel at one point today. That makes every drop of the stuff pumped out of the ground ever more profitable, especially if it can be pumped here in the United States without all that expensive time in oil tankers bringing it from overseas. The rush for oil exploration in the western part of this country has come as a shock to a lot of homeowners out here who are finding that even though they own the land, they don't own what's underneath it, and they can't control how oil companies go get it. Wyoming Public Radio's Molly Messick has the story now from Cheyenne.
Not long ago, about 70 residents of a housing development celebrated the start of a new organization to make sure they don't suffer if oil rigs move in.
We're trying to protect our property value.
Barry Bruins is a retired Air Force officer. He lives in the subdivision called North Star Ranch. It's a collection of spacious houses surrounded by prairie. Several months ago, he and his neighbors learned that an oil and gas company had leased the minerals beneath their houses.
I would like to have an agreement that says if there's anything that happens that wrecks our value of our property, we are made whole without having a bunch of litigation, without having this thing drawn out for years. This is all agreed on ahead of time.
For people who have spent years saving up for a house, there's a lot to be worried about. Take Lorenda Mayberry. She's a stay-at-home mom who moved from California with her husband and three sons. Mayberry says the news that an oil company could drill here caught her completely off guard.
I was actually devastated.
For months, she's been trying to figure out what might happen in her neighborhood.
Really concerned about our water, traffic, dust, noise. I'm not sure if they're going to put a pipeline through. I'm pretty much thinking that anything's possible.
The mineral leaseholder is a multi-billion dollar company called Noble Energy. Mayberry and other North Star homeowners say they want Noble to take specific steps before any drilling can happen. They want tests of all water wells, and they want home appraisals. For the homeowners, the dilemma lies in what's called split estate. If that's a term you've never heard before, then what it means might surprise you. It's basically dual ownership of a piece of land. Split estate dates back to the early 1900s, when the federal government gave away ranch land but held on to the minerals below the surface. County Attorney Mark Voss says that for regular homeowners, the fact that they don't own the mineral rights can be an easy detail to overlook.
They're just buying a home to raise their kids in and let the dogs play in the yard. They're not thinking about what's under the ground. And unfortunately, somebody thought about that a long time ago and split the estate. And now we face the consequences.
In Wyoming and across the country, a company's right to extract minerals carries a lot of legal weight. In fact, Voss says, homeowners who only own the surface ultimately don't have any power to keep an oil company away.
The split estate law basically says that an oil company who has an interest in the mineral estate under the ground cannot be kept off of the property for purposes either of surveying for the minerals or for extracting the minerals.
In that case, what can the residents of North Star Ranch reasonably hope to negotiate? Noble Energy doesn't want to comment on the specifics of the situation, but the company has met with the homeowners and says it will work with all local stakeholders. And for now, the homeowners say they're optimistic.
What we want to do is try and find a way that all of us win.
Jim Ruby is the president of the North Star Association and a staffer at a state environmental agency.
They get to do their exploration and development, and we get to keep what we got, and that everything stays just as if they weren't here.
Ruby says that if the North Star residents' negotiation works out, perhaps they can stand as a model to others across the West. From Cheyenne, Wyoming, I'm Molly Messick for Marketplace.
Billions of dollars worth of cargo goes back and forth across the oceans every day. It's just about the cheapest way to get something from point A to point B. But there are real costs to the environment beyond just fuel and diesel engine exhaust. Think for a second about the stuff that falls off those ships and out into the ocean. That's what happened in 1992 when the cargo ship Evergreen Everlaurel, bound from Hong Kong to the port of Tacoma, Washington, hit rough seas and lost 12 containers. One of those containers was full of bath toys, rubber duckies, 28,800 of them. Donovan Hone writes about the missing toys and how he set about tracking them down in his new book, Moby Duck. Donovan, good to have you here.
Hi, Kai.
So I'm going to start someplace I don't usually start, which is reading the full subtitle of this book, and it goes like this. The true story of 28,800 bath toys lost at sea and of the beachcombers, oceanographers, environmentalists, and fools, including the author, who went in search of them. So why'd you go in search?
Why'd I go in search?
Yeah.
There are many different answers to that, but the two that I think are the most important ones are, when I heard this story, I found myself wanting to imagine it, this idea of rubber duckies, as the news stories usually said, going adrift. And then I suppose the second was that oceanographers began trying to map where the toys went, and there's witchcraft in a map. I wanted to follow their trail.
This is, or was, I suppose, since it's done, a quest in the truest sense of the word. I mean, you were gone for long periods of time.
Yeah, I was. Tell my wife about it.
Yeah, well, we'll get there in a minute. We should probably point out, though, that even though they were called rubber duckies, they're actually plastic.
Yep.
And the discovery that you made was that our oceans are crowded with plastic and all kinds of stuff that happens in the course of everyday global trade.
That's right. I mean, when I set out on the quest, I thought it was just going to be an adventure, but the currents carried me to an environmental story that I'd never heard about, which is the accumulation of plastics at sea.
Tell me about this place called the North Pacific Gyre.
That's the scientific term for this circuit of currents that circle the North Pacific from East Asia to the North Pacific Northwest of America and back around. And at the heart of that gyre, there's the technical name is a mouthful. It's called the North Pacific Subtropical Convergence Zone. And the currents there end up collecting flotsam that drifts into them. Things can float around in there for a long time.
And they do. And in point of fact, at one point, this oceanographer hands you, I think it's an old fishing net, right? And he says...
Yeah, drift net floats. Yeah, that floats that would hold them, yeah.
And he said, listen, hold on to this for a second. And you did, and then you put it down. And he said, okay, now look at your hand.
And there were little grains of foamed plastic that looked a bit like pollen, which is the fate of much of what is out there. You know, there's these images of what has become popularly known as the Pacific Garbage Patch. That name suggests almost some sort of floating junkyard. Mm. And it's not what it looks like because the stuff does degrade in sunlight. It doesn't biodegrade. Nothing can eat it. But it does break down into fragments and then eventually into dust that blows through the water column like dust through air.
I don't want to spoil the ending to this story, but there were reports that these little rubber duckies had somehow ridden these currents up into the Bering Strait between Alaska and Russia and across the polar ice cap and down to the east coast of the United States. Did that pan out?
Well, that was probably the most preoccupying mystery. That's the one that took a book to answer, in a way. There was one credible sighting in Maine, but the beachcombers didn't keep the evidence. I have my suspicions in the end, but to this day, in 2007, they were supposed to arrive in England, and no one found them there either. So no one has yet found a sure thing.
I want to ask you for a minute about your son. Bruno pops up every now and then through this book, and then when you turn the last page, he's 3 years old, and you guys are throwing pine cones into the Hudson River down at the south end of Manhattan. But you were gone for long stretches while this guy was a kid.
I was.
And I wonder how that went, because that would have killed me.
Well, it was probably, in a weird way, more than seafaring and rough weather, I will say, the hardest part of the trip. Initially, when I set out doing this, I had this idea of the title, Moby Duck, which was a little bit of a joke, but also because if I have to name a favorite novel, that's it. And one of the things I noticed on the last time I read it was how much fatherhood was on Melville's mind. And I noticed in a biography that he actually became a father during the course of writing Moby Dick, too. So it's there.
Donovan Hone. The book is called Moby Duck. There is a huge, long subtitle, which you can check out on our website, our new book blog. It's called marketplace.org/thebigbook. We've got a map of where Donovan went. We've got pictures. We've got an excerpt you can read. All kinds of good stuff. Donovan, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which sustainability runs into its, wait, hold everything moment. You know how big polluters, or anybody really, if they want to reduce their environmental impact, can buy what are called carbon offsets, emissions credits, really, from sustainable sources of energy to offset whatever the pollution in question is? Well, it turns out that North Korea's got a lot of hydropower, and they want to sell some offsets. They're short of cash, you know. The UN has expressed an interest in buying them. Could net Kim Jong-il a couple of $1 million a year. And with that, that is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow gave back 79 points, two-thirds of 1%. The NASDAQ shed 39 points, about 1.4%. The S&P 500 lost 11 points, eight-tenths on a percentage scale. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time back here, if a lot of people follow you on Twitter, and I mean a lot of people, and then you don't follow them back, what does that make you?
So some people might indeed call us jerks, or since we're talking Twitter here, they might call us twerks.
Yeah, he said it, not me. Another episode of Freakonomics Radio. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Did you see the plug there? Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.